So this week we turn our attention to Chag HaPesach, Haba Aleinu Latova, and of course there's a great deal to say, Kol Hamar B'Harei Zeh Meshubach. Interesting to mention, we may have mentioned in the past, the very name that we give to the Chag, Chag HaPesach, and that's how it's called, is actually not the way that the Torah refers to it. The Torah calls it Chag HaMatzos. The Torah never calls it Chag HaPesach. In fact, in a more detailed sense, what the Torah calls Pesach will be referred to the Korban Pesach, which is actually the afternoon before Pesach begins. That's the time frame called Pesach. The Torah calls the Chag Chag HaMatzos. Interestingly, so do we in davening. We will refer to it by its quote-unquote official name, Chag HaMatzos, Patite Nanu as Chag HaMatzos, and Yale V'Yavos, Yom Chag HaMatzos. We call it Pesach there, but everywhere else, when we discuss it, we will call it Pesach. The Masechet is called Maseches Psachim. And the classic explanation as to why this is so is that we have this ongoing reciprocal and mutual relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whereby we focus wherever we can on him, and he, so to speak, for his part, focuses on us. As we mentioned a few weeks ago, the famous Gemara in Brachos Daf Vav regarding the mysterious concept of the tefillin that Hashem wears. The Gemara says, well, once you find out what that means, that Hashem wears tefillin, so what does it say in his tefillin? What do the parshiyos say? We say in our tefillin, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. What does it say in Hashem's tefillin? Also Shema Yisrael? Says the Gemara in Hashem's tefillin, it says, U'mi ka'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. That's the kesher tefillin. That's the connection. And similarly, therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls the Chag Chag HaMatzos because this is the aspect of the Chag that really highlights the Jewish people's triumph as they, and moreover their gesture, Lechtei Chacharei Bamidbar, they left so quickly, they didn't prepare, Hashem said, it's time to go, and they went, at Lo Yachlu L'Hismamea, and the result was Matzos. And therefore, Matzos represents the swiftness with which we responded to Hashem's call to leave, and that's why Hashem recalls this Chag, Chag HaMatzos. It's about the Jewish people's exodus. For our part, we call it Chag HaPesach, which, as we say, Pesach al Shum Ma, al Shum Shepasach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's about that final act of Rachmanus that Hashem had when he skipped over our houses and spared all of the houses of Israel, but not Poes Mitzrayim, and therefore, whereas Hashem calls it Chag HaMatzos to emphasize the Jewish people's role, we will refer to it as Chag HaPesach to lay emphasis on his role. And so, be that as it may, Chag HaPesach, Chag HaMatzos, we begin often before the Yom Tovim with a matter of halachic interest, and the one that I've been waiting a long time to discuss and present is that of Mechiras Chametz, selling chametz. There is an enormous literature on the selling chametz. There's many, many details. We, of course, focus on the major principles and the highlights. Efes kotsehu nire v'chulo lo nire. I remember my Zayda, Olav HaShalom, he said the efes kotsehu, the best translation for the word efes there is to say it in Yiddish, efes. Efes kotsehu, we'll see efes, some of it, but not all of it. And so, let's firstly talk about the background. Before we discuss the mechira, the sale of chametz, what is it coming to address? What's the score when it comes to chametz? As we know, the halachos of chametz are extremely severe, not only in terms of eating chametz, goes through great lengths to be sure that even not a drop or a crumb, chas v'chalila, but there is also an issur of owning chametz, which rarely you have, things that are osur to eat or also to own, but when it comes to chametz, it's also to eat, to get benefit, and also to own, known in the parlance as bali roye, or bali motze. There's a Torah prohibition against owning chametz. Now, this prohibition actually has ramifications in two spheres, and it's important to maintain consciousness of both of them. On the one hand, there is the aveira itself of owning chametz on Pesach, and that lasts for however long Pesach lasts. Once Pesach has finished, a person did an Aveira, that's a terrible thing, but ostensibly that's history. However, the Rabbanon, in order to further promote awareness and conscientiousness with regards to this matter, the Rabbanon leveled a knas, a penalty for anyone who did violate the prohibition of owning chametz and Pesach, that even after Pesach, that chametz can't be used, not by the person and not by anyone else. That's what's known as chametz she'avar alav ha-Pesach. Okay? And therefore, certainly, one doesn't want to, for either of those two very good reasons, be in any possession of chametz on Pesach. The question is, what to do? Well, as we know, there exists in the Torah a concept, or on a Torah level, a concept called bittul, chametz, nullification of chametz. What does that mean? A person declares his chametz null and void. What is the effect of that? Perhaps it becomes a matter of worthlessness. It may even become hefker. We say hefker, actually. That's our nusach of the bittul. And presumably, once a person has been said the bittul and nullified their chametz, that's that. I mean, it's there in order to avoid violating the prohibition of owning chametz. So if a person has been mevatlas, nullified their chametz, they no longer have a problem. However, the Yerushalmi states, and it's paskened in the Shulchan Aruch and Simen Taf Mem Ches, bittul is not alone. It's not enough. Bittul alone is not enough. If a person did bittul and then that's it, but left the chametz where it is, that chametz also can't be used after Pesach, says the Yerushalmi. That's not enough just to do bittul. And there are many explanations why, but the simplest explanation is that if it's really worthless, why are you putting it away? If you really desire not to own it, so then why are you keeping it? Which means that keeping it in your premises is a glaring question mark on your bittul. So you need to follow through, make good on your bittul, and put your chametz where your mouth is, and not just leave it lying around. And four, the pure application of the idea of bittul is that anything, any chametz that you're aware of, destroy it physically. Get rid of it. If you're not aware of chametz, then you may still have it, so for that you should do bittul. Once you've done that, you seem to be completely okay, because there's no chametz you're aware of that you're keeping, and whatever you're not aware of, you did bittul, you should be okay. Now, against all of this background, and between all of these moving parts, there is the notion of selling chametz. Where does it come from, and how is it meant to help us, and do we need to be helped? So, to begin at the beginning, and Rav Zevin, in his wonderful presentation on Mechiras Chametz in the Sefer Mo'adim Bahalacha, really breaks down what he calls the hishtalshelut of Mechiras Chametz, the way that things transition from scenario to scenario, into four separate stages, as we will see. So if we begin at the beginning, when life is simple, the Mishnah, the very concept that one can sell chametz, which, by the way, makes perfect sense, because if you sell it, you don't own it, that's explicit in the Mishnah. The Mishnah in the beginning of the second perek of Maseches Pesachim says, as long as you're able to eat chametz and get benefit from chametz, you can sell it. And that's that. So Mechiras Chametz, the first time it's mentioned, the earliest reference. However, we should note that what the Mishnah is talking about when it discusses selling chametz, and what we're talking about, are arguably two separate things. The sale of the Mishnah is a one-directional sale. It's a permanent sale. You give him the chametz, and he eats it, and you'll never see it again. And he pays you for it, and it's a sale like any other sale. The question, and of course, there is no reason why one can't do that. That's what the Mishnah is talking about. But then the shaila is it possible to sell chametz? Is it acceptable to sell chametz whereby it's very likely that you will see it again? And you're actually hoping that you'll see it again. It's clear that you're selling him the chametz because he needs to own it for a certain time. Of course, if he doesn't want to give it back, you can't force him. I mean, that's not called a sale. But the expectation is that you will see it again. Is that a flaw? Or is that also acceptable? The Mishnah hasn't spoken about that. But here we have a Tosefta, and the Tosefta really is the source for what will become known to us as Mechiras Chometz. It's there in the second parak of Psachim, and it discusses a case where the Jew and the Nochri, they're on a boat, and there's plenty of Chometz there, difficult to know what to do until further notice. So, Yisrael v'goy shahayuboyim b'sfina. So the Yisrael, the Nochri, they're on a boat. The Chometz b'yad Yisrael. And the Jew has a lot of Chometz. So what's he going to do? Hareze mochro l'nochri. So he's allowed to sell it to the Nochri before Pesach. V'nosta b'matana, to give it over. He gifts it to him. V'chozer v'lokeach mimenu l'achar Pesach. And he's able and entitled to buy it back for him after Pesach. That's okay. And not only is it okay to buy it back after Pesach, the point of the Tosefta is he can expect to buy it back after Pesach. That's fine. Ubilvad sheyitnenu lo b'matano gemura. The only stipulation is that it's got to be a complete gift. That is to say, if he wants to make good on his purchase, there's no way you can force him to sell it back. However, you can be optimistic that indeed you will see it again, and perfectly acceptable. Now, you could say that case of the Tosefta, which is the beginnings of selling it with the expectation of seeing it again after Pesach, the question is that an institutionalized psak, or perhaps it's a contingency? After all, the Tosefta began with a story, the Jew and the Nochri on a boat. It sounds like something of perhaps shas hadchak, an emergency of sorts. Perhaps it would not be acceptable under normal circumstances where there's no reason not to take it, you know, to give it to him permanently. But nonetheless, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the Tosefta, and it's acceptable as a matter of course. You can do this on a yearly basis. You can sell him your chometz with the expectation that you'll see it again, which sounds much closer to our Mechiras Chometz. The only thing is, the Shulchan Aruch emphasizes, both in the Beis Yosef and in the Shulchan Aruch, that the chometz has to leave your premises. And that's part of it. You give it to him, he can give it back to you, but kol odri hasn't given it back to you, the chometz actually changes domain from your house to his house. I mean, that's a sale. If he wants, he can sell it back, and if not, then not. Which means we're still a certain distance away from our mechiras chometz. And this began to be discussed in the generation or two after the Shulchan Aruch. The first one to talk about it was the Bach, the Bayis Chadash, in his Perush on the Tor. And the background to his discussion is that in his time in Europe, it was very common for a Jew to be involved, and this was his parnasa, in spirits, in grain-based spirits, whiskey and the like, or whatever else they had at the time. And someone for whom that's his parnasa, and the Jews didn't have that many jobs available. It was a very widespread thing that the Jew was the whiskey vendor. That's a lot of chometz. And moreover, it wasn't feasible to get rid of all of it from his premises. I mean, he had a whole warehouse full of it. I mean, there's no way that you can give that to the Nochri. You can put one barrel on top of him. I mean, if he opens it, he's not going to get home anyway. And therefore, to have the entire thing. And moreover, there were laws governing this. I mean, the laws were very strict about this. You needed to have a license. Everything that moved needed to be ratified, etc. It was unfeasible to move it. And therefore, and these are the words of the Bach, b'medina zo, right, in this locale, right, Poland, rov iskenu b'yayin sarof, right, most Jews, or many Jews, were involved in whiskey and the spirits. And it would be a terrible financial loss to have no option. And therefore, this was the first we hear of the notion of selling chometz, and it's his, but it doesn't move. It's still on your premises. Now, this is a major transition, a major development. And the reason why, and this is not so well known, is that unless you do something else, you are not out of the woods. Because the halacha happens to be that not only is there an isser of owning your own chometz, of having your own chometz on the premises, there's an isser of having a non-Jew's chometz as a deposit, at least if you accept responsibility for it. If you're liable in case of loss or theft, that's still bali roi bali motzei. which means if the chametz doesn't leave the premises, then you actually haven't achieved anything by selling it to the nachri. It's just gone from one channel of bali roe to a second. It's no longer yours, but it's the nachri. It's a deposit deposited by you, and you'd still be liable for it, which means it's still also to own it on a Torah level. And that now has to be dealt with. Now, the simple solution, if only the nachri will agree, and by the time you're finished, you're going to need to find a nachri who's got a lot of patience and a lot of goodwill, is not to accept liability for it, is not to accept responsibility. I mean, that's, he's taking a chance. Maybe he'll pay less. But to say this chametz is yours, it's on my premises, if anything happens, please understand, I do not accept, management does not accept responsibility for theft or loss of any of your chametz on my premises. If he agrees, maybe you're out of the woods. However, what became much more widespread, and now the sale of chametz is expanding, the more commonly accepted solution is not only to sell him the chametz, but to lease him the places where the, in your house where the chametz is. And that now becomes a whole new vista of mechiras chametz, because once you've leased that area to him, the room or the section of the room, whatever it may be, so that's now considered for chametz purposes to be his premises, it's his chametz on his premises, and you're out of the woods. And therefore, now, the sale of chametz involves two things, selling him the chametz, and leasing him a certain amount of your property. That's a whole new wing now has been opened up. It's also very important that even if the chametz is his and it's on his property, etc., which you've leased to him, it should be clearly marked and inaccessible to you. That's very important, because people are quite hamish with their own chametz throughout the year, and therefore you do not wish in the middle of the night to get up and forget that it's really his chametz, etc. So it needs to be marked away, and also hard to get at. That's why we tape it up and lock it up and whatever it is that people do. That's also important. It can't be in the middle of your dining room table, and the good news is you've leased your dining room table and the chametz to the nachri. It's got to be put away and made inaccessible. Now, so far, as much as we've moved from chametz with expectation to see again and chametz that's now no longer moving, there's still a fourth transitional period. And that is that until now, we've been discussing what's really a private arrangement between the Jew and the Nochri. And the Jews were surrounded by Nochrim. It wasn't hard to find one. It may be hard to find one who accepts all of your terms. But they really made the sale between them. The problem is, the more widespread this became, the harder it was to manage the sale of chametz. Because actually, the sale of chametz to a nachri can be quite complicated, and therefore to leave it in the hands of the layman was considered ill-advised. And therefore, once many people began to sell their chametz, it became considered the better idea for it to be localized and organized, and the rav of the community would sell on everyone's behalf. And that now became mechiras chametz as we know it. To be very clear, you do not sell your chametz to the Rav. The Rav doesn't want your chametz. He's as Jewish as you, if not more so. He doesn't want to be in ownership, not of his chametz and not of yours. So it's not selling chametz to the Rav, it's selling the chametz through the Rav to the Nachri. The Rav thereby becomes your shaliach. How do you make the Rav your shaliach? Well, in strictly speaking, it's very easy. You say to him, I'd like you to be my shaliach. There are other ways to solidify the relationship. We do what's called a kinyan suda. You pick up the pen, or you pick up the handkerchief, whatever it is. That just further gives weight and consolidates the appointment as a shaliach. And as a shaliach, he sells the chametz for you. And the rav, of course, knows what he's doing, certainly better than his congregants. So, to summarize so far, because we've gone through about 2,000 years, but there are four discernible stages, once again. Firstly, we have the classic, you sell it to him like you'd sell anything to him, you'll never see it again. That's what the Mishnah is talking about. Then we had stage two from the Tosefta, you sell it hoping, expecting, maybe even intimating that you'd like to see it again. That's also acceptable, as long as you don't make it a condition. That's what we saw from the Tosefta in the boat. And then we saw the sale of chametz even when it doesn't leave your premises, which brings with it its own questions. And finally, the sale of chametz is not even conducted. Most Jews have no notion of who is the nochri, who actually is now the owner of the chametz. They've never met him, and they've never spoken to him, and maybe they never will. And that's mechiras chametz as we have. Now, one of the questions that relates to, shall we say, the heart of mechiras chametz is, how does mechiras chametz relate to the other thing that we do, which is bittul chametz? We've got all of our chametz, and we nullify it, and we sell it. And the question is, are they two ways of doing the same thing? Do they go together? Do they get in each other's way? And this is a very interesting shaila. Although there were some who held that actually bittul and mechira, they work together as a team. First you do bittul, and then you do mechira. Other great poskim were actually reluctant to see it that way. They saw them as being antithetical to each other. Because when you think about it, if you mevatel your chometz, you're saying, this is worthless to me. And then you're saying, I would like it to sell it to a nochri. Well, apparently it's not worthless. It could be that the move to sale nullifies your nullification. So you're ruining the bittul by trying to sell what you were just mevatel. If you try and reverse it and sell first, so then you can't be mevatel anymore. You can't be mevatel chometz that's not yours. So it sounds like you can't do both. You can't nullify your chometz and then sell it, or vice versa. And therefore, according to those poskim, actually, whatever chometz you're aware of, that's the chometz that you sell. And you're not nullifying that chometz. You can't. It's not yours to nullify. You sell, and that's that. Your bittul is more on chometz that you're not aware of, and that's already not so much in the realms of the sale, you don't know about it, and bittul. That's the simple understanding. This is the position of the Balatanya and others. However, there are poskim, and it's very interesting just for us to consider, what are we saying? When we say all of my chometz is bottle, do we mean all of it? Even the chometz in the cupboard or in the garage that I've locked away, is that also bottle? But some say yes. They really do go together, because bittul means I have no interest in it and I don't want to own it. Mechira, sale, is really heading in the same direction. I don't want to own it. If someone will pay me money for it, all the better. But in a sense, because they're heading in the same direction, they could corroborate each other. There could be synergy between them, and you do bittul on the chometz, and then you sell the very same chometz. So that's a very, very interesting shaila. Now, probably one of the most complicated questions about mechira is, which thankfully is not our concern, it's the rabbi's concern, is how do you sell your chametz? I mean, how exactly, what does that sale look like? What happens between the rav and the nochri? You see, there is a major discussion amongst the mefarshim what's the best way, or maybe only acceptable way, to effect a transaction between Yisrael and a nochri. And some say it's dafka one type of kinyan, and others say it's dafka another type of kinyan. And this was a large part of the controversy, which there was controversy in certain times, with regard to this, as to, are you getting the kinyan right? Lamaisa, nowadays, many sales of chametz have multiple kinyanim, piled up one on top of the other, just to leave no stone unturned, hopefully. Which means that the nochri pays some money. He does not give the full value of the entire town's chometz. I mean, if he was that rich, he would not live in that town. Which means he gives some of the money, which is considered an advance. And the rest is money that he owes if he wants to retain possession. But the advance is enough. And they do a kinyan sudur, which is once again with a pen or with a handkerchief, which is also a form of a kinyan. Interestingly, what we mentioned before, that you lease some of your property to him, may be very helpful here. Because once you're leasing your property, it's possible that the chometz could go through in what's called the kinyan agav, piggybacking on top of the kinyan, apropos, or tofes tramp, they would say around here, with the lease of the property comes the chometz. And it's also possible that if he owns your property or that part of it, he naturally owns the chometz inside anyway, which is known as a kinyan chotzer. So these are just referencing some of the kinyonim. Many sales do all of them, in which case every base seems to be covered. Now, an important question is, with regards to the mechira, one has to ask at a certain stage, is this a real sale? Meaning, is it... different people ask this question for different reasons, but if we just, in the most innocent of ways, is it an effective sale? After all, we know that he's going to sell the chametz back. I'm not sure if the Nochri ever decided to keep the chametz. Is that okay? Well, the answer is yes. I mean, the sale works. For what it is, it works 100%. It is true that it is, or certainly looks like, what's called a harama. A harama is like a ruse or a device, an evasive tactic. And that it is. But that doesn't mean that the sale doesn't work. But it's important that a person be real with the sale. That is important. That means, in principle, you have to commit fully to the sale, which means a number of things. It means that you have to be prepared for the contingency that the Nochri actually wants some of your chametz. It's got to be clear to you, you would absolutely give it to him. He also needs to have access to the chametz. Back in the day, the demand was that he have a key to the premises, so that he can go and get his chametz whenever he wants. Nowadays, that's not considered to be so practical, but at the very least, that he should know where you are, he should have your phone number, or whatever it is, and if he calls, assuming he doesn't call in the middle of the night, you should make the chametz accessible to him. If a person travels overseas, he needs to let the Rav know where the key to his house is. He can't have, the goy can't be locked out of his chametz. If a person has moral compunctions or misgivings about the sale, which he doesn't need to, but if he does, he probably shouldn't sell. Because if his heart isn't in it, that's probably the most threatening thing to the effectiveness of the sale. But the minhag, in any case, is yes to sell, and it's perfectly okay. However, we should know, it should be noted, there are those who are machmir not to sell chametz gomer. Chametz gomer means real, honest to goodness chametz, cereals and noodles and cookies and cakes and all of that. Actual chametz, for this reason. In other words, because they're not comfortable with dealing with the d'oraisa problem of owning chametz by a sale that they know they'll get back. They sell other things. They sell mixtures of chametz and all sorts of other things, but not actual chametz. Chametz be'en, what's called. And this is the minhag of the Vilna Gaon and others who follow him. In fact, someone who supported very forcefully this minhag of not selling chametz gomer, kedai to mention, was Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, on any forum that he had, whether it's his Talmidim or his Kehila, encouraged people not to sell chametz gomer for this reason. Rather, chametz gomer they should actually get rid of, and they should rely on the mechira for mixtures of chametz and things like that. Okay, but nonetheless, there was a widespread minhag to sell everything, whatever you want to sell, which is okay. And in fact, if we come back to the other side of Pesach, that is to say, once Pesach has finished, so now the question is, can I buy from my makolet, chametz, real chametz items? Now he's got a teudah. Without a teudah, it's nothing, because why would you not have a teudah? That means that he didn't sell. But if he has a teudah that he sold, so the question is, well, can I buy chametz from him? So the answer comes in two waves. Firstly, yes, because me'ikar hadin, it's acceptable to sell chametz, and if he's got a teudah that he sold chametz, that means he's fine, that's number one. And number two, even people, and here, remember, owning chametz on Pesach is a Torah prohibition. Eating chametz that was owned on Pesach is a drabonon prohibition, which means that even though many people are machmir when it comes to not relying on a sale of actual chametz, that's for Pesach itself because it's d'oraisa. But once Pesach has finished and it's drabonon, so even if the matter is in doubt, which it isn't, it would be mutter to rely on the fact that the makolet has sold the chametz. It's mutter to straight away. Although there are those who are machmer even there, and they do not buy chametz items that were sold over Pesach, but rather they wait for new. One of them was Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He himself personally, in many respects, was very machmer, and here as well, he did not use anything from makolet that had been sold. However, anyone who came to ask him, is it mutter? He would tell them without hesitation that it's mutter. In fact, there was a kashrus organization who tried to enlist his support in having the food manufacturers timestamp all of the food so that you'll know whether it was made from flour before Chametz or before Pesach, after Pesach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman refused. He did not, he was not prepared to get involved, because he says, on a widespread basis, to institute such a thing, you're implying that the Mechira didn't work. That's not true. If a person wants to be Machmir personally, that's their prerogative. But anything to put it into the Rishus HaRabim, not at all. And these, therefore, are the practices in terms of buying Chametz that's been sold by the makolet or whatever over Pesach. There is a chumrah on top of that, which is not to use flour that was sold as well, because the flour is water, and sometimes it could become chametz, but that's considered to be excessive according to pretty much everyone. It's considered unnecessary, because flour, even if it's been washed, it's not known that it was washed, pre-washed, it's not known that it came into contact with water enough to become chametz, and worst case scenario, it's suffik chametz, and suffik chametz can certainly go through in the sale. And I saw in the writings of Rav Sternbuch, he calls it a chumra yaseira, an excessive chumra. And if you know Rav Sternbuch, if he calls it an excessive chumra, that means that's exactly what it is, and unnecessary to worry about that. Even though it's a bit of a craze, a bit of a thing, but unnecessary by any standard halachically. And so, sof davar, having gone through at least the major points of the sale, the three things to remember is. The sale itself is fine. It's 100% okay, and there is a widespread minhag to rely on it for all types of chametz. If a person could get rid of their own chametz gomor, all the better. I mean, that's a mitzvah of tashbisu. But even a person who has, they should still sell. This is what Shlomo Zalman said. Because, and again, especially nowadays, when there's no such thing as a pure food anymore, all types of foods have all kinds of everything mixed up inside of them. Even something that looks very straightforward, sometimes it's not the case. That's why certain for eating purposes, you never have something that doesn't have hashgacha, because even something like salt, for example, I mean, salt is salt. But salt sometimes has an anti-clumping agent, which is from wheat starch, which is chametz. And it doesn't advertise, because it's not considered relevant for purchase of salt. And therefore, anything that a person puts away for Pesach, certainly they should sell. There is no need to sell your kelim, your chametz dikah kelim. That for one doesn't need to go. And in fact, it's considered unadvisable to sell your kelim, because if you did, you'd have to toivel them after Pesach, having repurchased them back from a nochri, and therefore that's it's unnecessary. And that is a survey, shall we say, of mechiras chametz. Of course, there's plenty more to say on each of these details, but at least to get some type of working understanding of this incredible institution, which is called Mechiras Chametz. And from there, the Chametz has been sold, and we approach Haggadah Shel Pesach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a fascinating comment, because when does the Haggadah begin? What's the first thing we say in the Haggadah? Kadesh or Kiddush? Well, actually, the first thing we say is the poem of Kadesh, Orchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, and it seems to be nothing we couldn't have said ourselves. It's the stages of the Seder. There are other poems, actually. There's a number of them, but this is the one that's been accepted. It's from Rishonim, says of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So you need to take a look very carefully. It's interesting to note that there are two washings. In the poems, two washings in the Seder. There's before Karpas and there's before Matzah. They're both mentioned in the poem, but they're not mentioned in exactly the same way. The one before Karpas is called Urchatz, and before Matzah is called Rachza. What's the difference grammatically between them? The root is the same, Lirchotz, to wash, but Rachatz is a command. Rachza is an infinitive, it's washing. What's the difference between wash and washing? That's an interesting shaila. And of course, the unacceptable answer is Urchatz rhymes with Yachatz and Rachza rhymes with Matzah. And Shlomo Zalman said, you know, it's a very interesting question. The Poskim debate this. Why do we wash our hands before Karpas? So the answer, of course, is, assuming the answer is not so that children should ask, in which case that there's nothing we can do about that. But if there is an answer, it's about the issue of what's called tivulo b'mashke. That means food that you dip into a liquid, it comes to contact with liquid. One also needs netilas yadayim for that. Now the question is, well, does one? I mean, just on other days of the year, is that so? And here there are different minhagim. Some always wash. It's very interesting. The tilas yadayim always wash. If their food will come into contact with water, even that means dipping vegetables in water or dipping a biscuit in tea or coffee. It's the same thing. Some even wash with a bracha. That's the opinion of the Vilna Gaon. Al netilas yadayim. Also on Seder night, Urchatz is with netilas yadayim, which of course we don't do. But there is a widespread minhag not to wash for things that are tivulo b'mashke. That's the opinion of Tosfos. Tosfos say this is shayach to the Beis HaMikdash. It's not operational in our times. And the question is, if it's not operational in our times, then why do we do it on Seder night? And that's the question of the Taz. Ma nishtana halayla zemikol halaylos. If it's not something you need to do every night, why do you do it tonight? But the Netziv says the answer is because Seder night is a night where we try and simulate or bring in as much as we can from the way things were done in the Beis HaMikdash. That's why we do Zecher LeMikdash, and therefore this is also Zecher LeMikdash. Everyone holds it in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, you need to wash. So we don't wash because we do so every day, for those that don't. But we wash tonight because it's Zecher LeMikdash. And in fact, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, it's a fascinating point. That's why Urchatz begins with a vav. I think you could read that poem many times and notice that of all the things, it's only Urchatz that starts with a vav. Kadesh Urchatz, and then Karpas Yachatz. It's not Kadesh Urchatz, Vekarpas, Veyachatz. So there's no vav linking or any of the others, but there's a vav linking Kadesh to Urchatz. It should have said Kadesh Rechatz. Why is there a vav? So Shlomo Zalman says, because the rachatz here doesn't stand on its own. You're only washing because of Kedushas Halayla, because of the sanctity of the night. And therefore, rachatz is directly connected to Kadesh. That, hence, Kadesh Urchatz. From Kadesh leads you to rachatz. Fascinating. And moreover, says Shlomo Zalman, it seems that whoever wrote this poem of the Rishonim sided with Tosfos, that this is not something that you normally do to wash for Tivula B'mashke. Why do I say that? So Rav Shlomo Zalman says, the difference between telling a person to do something or just mentioning the idea is that if they have no notion that they should do this, you need to tell them to do it. But if everyone knows that you do it, just mention it and then they do it. On Friday night, after Kiddush, someone will say, Netilas Yadayim. No one says, Titlu Yadayim. Because everyone knows that that's what you do after Kiddush. They're just waiting for the signal. And that's why before matzah, it says rachtzah. And rachtzah means washing. Because if you're about to eat matzah, everyone knows you have to wash. You just tell them that. That's the time. You just mention the concept. But the washing before karpas isn't something people normally do. If you say rachtzah, they don't know what you're talking about. And that's why you have to say, unusually, rechatz, wash your hands now. That's the difference between the command, so to speak, of rechatz, where otherwise you wouldn't have done it, and rachtzah, where everyone will do it as soon as you tell them it's time to wash. The only thing is, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, in the interest of thoroughness, isn't it true that Kaddish also is in a command? Everyone knows that you make Kiddush. However, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, the reason why we don't just say Kiddush, but we say Kaddish, is because everyone knows you do Kiddush, but there's a halach on Seder night to make Kiddush as soon as possible when you come home. And therefore, Kaddish means make Kiddush now. Those are his comments with regards to it. One wouldn't think that the Torah begins with the poem, but the poem's from Rishonim, and Rav Shlomo Zalman had what to say. I did not realize until this afternoon that I would be spending the rest of the shiur this evening on Halach Ma'anya, because I thought we never get past Halach Ma'anya, and Mirtz Hashem, next week we will, but we have to say something, because something I came across an idea which I think is major for Halach Ma'anya, and it's a statement not only about this paragraph, but about the entire Seder, which is important also. There's a certain mystique around Halach Ma'anya, but there has to be more than that because it begins the Seder. So as we know, the words are well known, Halach Ma'anya, Halach Basana, Ba'ardi Mitzrayim. We say this is the bread of affliction, or the poor bread that we ate in Mitzrayim. Then we say, Kol Dichven Yesev V'Yechal, whoever's hungry, let them come and eat. And then we say, Ashata Acha, L'shana Ba Ba'ardi Yisrael. Now the questions on Halach Ma'anya are many, and they'll always be the same. Number one, why is Halach Ma'anya in Aramaic? which it is. This is before any cups of wine, or just maybe just the one. So we should notice that it doesn't look like Hebrew, and none of the rest of the Seder is in Aramaic. Why is this paragraph? The classic answer, which is normally offered, is that it's important for everyone to understand the Seder, and it, back in the day, people spoke Aramaic better than they spoke Hebrew. And therefore, all should understand, and that remains true for the Seder. The Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rimi London of the Balei HaTosfos, who would say the Seder to his family in English. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. It is important for everyone to know. But it seems to be a token gesture towards that, because there are many much more important parts of the Seder that you need to know. We don't say them in Aramaic. Not Pesach, Matzah, and Mor, or you're not Yotzi Yedechova if you don't say them. So why just this one paragraph? And certainly now, these, if the goal is to say it in a language people understand, it should have shifted long ago from Aramaic to English or whatever language people speak. Moreover, what do we say about the... we say, Holach Ma'anya, it sounds like we're talking about the Matzah. The problem is, in an hour or two, we're going to say the exact opposite about the Matzah. When we raise the question, Matzah Zushanu Ochlim, why do we eat Matzah? We don't say this is a remembrance to the affliction and we ate it in Mitzrayim. We say this is a remembrance to the deliverance. We left so quickly, didn't have time to rise. That's a counter message. That's a contradiction. And if anyone remembers at that time what they said in Holach Ma'anya, they should be conflicted. Furthermore, we go on to say, Kodich ben Yeseh v'yechal. I mean, this is such heartwarming words, Kodich ben Yeseh v'yechal, until you realize that it's unlikely that anyone has ever accepted this invitation in the history of all the Seders of the Jewish people. Because you've come home already, and you close your door, and you make Kiddush. There is a wonderful tradition of hospitality on Seder night. It normally is arranged somewhat more in advance. At the very least, it's sure before you go home. But not when you're already home. Kodich ben Yeseh v'yechal, it's very easy to be magnanimous then. The only type of person that may conceivably take you up on your offer is someone who's followed you home and happens to be listening outside your door. And that's the type of person you probably would not want to let into your Seder. So what's the meaning of the Kodich ben Yeseh v'yechal? It's got such a ring to it, but it seems to be without meaning. And not only are you in the wrong location, you've already made Kiddush, which means if anyone ever did take you up on this invitation, they'd have to catch up with you. And there's nothing that makes a person more feel at home than the Baal HaBayis has already started. And then finally, Hashata Hocha, Lashana Baba Aridi Yisrael. It just seems to be all over the place. I mean, you've got three sections to Holach Ma'anya. Neither seems to be connected to none of them are connected to each other. It's just they're thrown together. But this is how we begin the Seder. And the one who discusses this, or many discuss, but the approach that really grabbed me this year is from Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa in the Nesivos HaMishpat, in his commentary on the Haggadah Ma'aseh Nisim. And the Ma'aseh Nisim says, to understand the significance of Holach Ma'anya, we need to ask a major question. It's known, by the way, Holach Ma'anya was not said when in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. It was added on later on, which means it has a message for us. And it's an important question. If we don't ask that question, we may not have connected fully with what Pesach is all about. Consider, says the Ma'aseh Nisim, someone who was enslaved or captured and he was set free, is it reasonable and meaningful that he should celebrate the day that he was set free? Certainly, the anniversary of his freedom, it's a wonderful occasion. What should happen if that person was captured, set free, and then captured again? Imagine him in captivity the second time round, and it comes to the day that he was released from the first place. But he's gone out of the frying pan into the fire. I mean, he's gone from one shibbut to another. Would we ever imagine in his second captivity he will mark and celebrate the anniversary of his first release? That's a sad situation to be in. Well, that's desperation and has no meaning. Now, if that's true, says the Ma'aseh Nisim, any Seder that takes place in Golos has to ask this question. Because we're yet in Golos. But we're celebrating Yetzias Mitzrayim. So we left Mitzrayim, but then we've ended up in all sorts of places. And some places were considerably better off than we were in Mitzrayim, and therefore this question perhaps bothers us less. And other places we're in circumstances which are analogous to those in Mitzrayim, in which case we have to wonder. And in other cases, not too long ago, there were people who were in circumstances which were much more dire than Mitzrayim. And on Seder night, we thank Hashem for taking us out of Mitzrayim. What is the meaning of this? What is the meaning of a Seder celebrating Yetzia from Golus when we're in Golus? In all of its variations. It doesn't seem to be what to celebrate. It seems to be somewhat mooted and obsolete. Says the Maase Nissim. That's a fair point. Unless, or until we consider. Imagine someone who, again, in our analogy, he was released once, but he's back in captivity. But his release from his first captivity will enable him to leave again. The basis of his hope to exit his current difficult situation is in his exit from the first. Such a person should mark and celebrate his original release, because that's what gives him hope to be released yet again. And what this means is we need to broaden our view of what Yetzias Mitzrayim is. When we left Mitzrayim, we weren't only leaving historically from that place, but we were enabling ourselves, or our Kodesh Baruch Hu enabled us, through taking us out of Mitzrayim, to have the capacity, when the time comes, to leave any other golus. And that can be understood in one of two ways. We say, every night, after Kriyat Shema, we say, Hashem took us out, Vayotze es Amu Yisrael, mitochem lecheirus olam. Cheirus olam is a very interesting term to translate. Normally we look at olam as something which is permanent. And it is permanent. But it's not obviously not permanent in the sense of uninterrupted. That's not true. Our freedom has been interrupted. And that's putting it mildly sometimes. So cheirus olam doesn't mean uninterrupted freedom, constant. But it means ultimate freedom. That means when Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, he gave us freedom in the ultimate sense that wherever we are, we will ultimately be freed from there as well. And the reason why is because Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim and made us his people. As his people, we cannot stay in Golus indefinitely, because when the Jewish people are in Golus, so Hashem is in Golus, his name is in Golus. And that's why we say, Umevi Goel of Nevenehem Leman Shemo Ba'ava. Shem's name is connected with us, and therefore in terms of his program for the world, the Jewish people, having attached his name to us, he has also vouchsafed for us that there is no Golus that will end us. We will end the Golus. And this is the Cheirus Olam that we're talking about, what we got when we left Mitzrayim. And that's the hope for Geula from any subsequent Golus. And moreover, in a slightly different vein, similar though, the Mefarshim tell us that the promise that was given to Avram, we say on Seder night, we raise a cup, V'hisha omda l'avoseinu v'lanu, and it is that which is stood by our fathers and by us. What is the V'hi? Well, what we've mentioned just beforehand is Hashem's promise to Avram. That your descendants will be enslaved and afflicted, but they will leave. And we say, V'hisha omda l'avoseinu v'lanu. That promise stood by our fathers, and it stands by us. Why does it stand by us? That is to say, the promise in terms of our forefathers has been fulfilled, and that's l'avoseinu. V'hisha omda l'avoseinu. But we say, no. V'hisha omda l'avoseinu v'lanu. Why does it stand by us as well? So one of the Rishonim, the Shibboleth HaLeket, explains that, you know, the Medrash tells us that when Hashem told Avram about all the golios the golos that his descendants will be in, he intimated and encapsulated in that foretelling all of the future golios. The Medrash tells us, commenting on the state that Avram fell into, v'hine ema chashecha gedola nofelalav, he went through this dark, dreadful state, and the Gemara attaches one of the golios, the Medrash attaches one of the golios to each of those words. Why is this so? After all, Dayal Tzara B'Shata, would it be enough just to deal with Mitzrayim and deal with other things later on? Why are they being referred to and incorporated into the discussion about Mitzrayim? Except the point is, says Shibale Aleket, that Golus Mitzrayim represents the seminal root Golus experience for the Jewish people. In a sense, we're familiar with the concept of Masa of a Simen Labonim, where things happen on a root level, and then that will enable them to happen on a branch level. The Jewish people's Masa of us for Golus was being in Mitzrayim. It represents the source of all types, of all of their subsequent Golios. The Chida in the Sefer Nachal Kedumim states that Shemos, which is the, as they come into Golos, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael, Haboim Mitzrayim. Haboim Mitzrayim, they're coming into Golos, means even beyond going down to Egypt, they're still coming into Golos later on. And the word, it says Haboim Mitzrayim, says the Chida, if you look at the word Boim, Beis, Aleph, Yud, and Mem, so that is Rosh HaTevis, Bovel, Edom, Yovan, Modai. Haboim Mitzrayim means all of the Golios, as the Jewish people are coming into Egypt, they're coming into to all of that ultimately. Here they're having this root experience. And that if that's true, then the promise to be delivered from Mitzrayim is thus a promise to be delivered from all of the emanating subsequent Golios. And that, says the Shibale HaLeket, is why we say V'hisha Omda L'Avaseinu V'lana. That promise, but it still stands by us because the subsequent Golios, which were also incorporated into that foretelling, the promise covers them as well. And therefore, says the Maaseh Nisim, to come back to Holach Ma'anya, it is no longer an assortment of disjointed sentences. Holach Ma'anya is a statement about what it means to have a Seder in Golos. And that is why it's written in Aramaic. Aramaic was the language of our first Golos that we entered into, having been already in Eretz Yisrael. And it represents Golos to a certain degree for us. And what do we say? We say Holach Mo'anya. This is poor bread. Now, like many others, the Maaseh Nisim understands that this is not a reference to the matzah. We're not saying this is matzah that our forefathers ate. Did they eat matzah in Egypt? Maybe. The Torah doesn't talk about it. There are other reports. Slaves used to eat matzah, harder to digest. They're less likely to come back for more anytime soon. And they get on with their work. but we don't have our own Masorah that we ate matzah as part of our slavery experience. But the Maaseh Nisim says, Lach ma'anya lechem means specifically bread, but ultimately it refers to all types of food. And it's a statement about the Seder. Holach Ma'anya means this is a poor Seder. Why is it poor? Because we're in Golos. Diachol Avasana Ba'ar de Mitzrayim, just like our forefathers ate in Egypt, right? Their food was poor, they were in Egypt, and to a degree so were we. And it sounds like, therefore, there isn't what to celebrate. But we do celebrate. This is the orientation towards a Seder in Golos. Is it worth having a Seder in Golos? 100%. And that's why we go on to say, Kol dich v'nyeseh v'yechol, whoever wants, let them come and join. What's the message here? It's not an actual invitation. A real invitation has been issued and accepted already. And if it wasn't, it's not going to be accepted now. Kol dich v'nyeseh v'yechol represents the mood of the people in the house. They feel like celebrating. Let others join us, whether they will or they won't, that's a question of their organization. But Kol dich v'nyeseh v'yechol means it's a celebration that is worth sharing with others. Why? Are we not back in Golos? Why celebrate Yetzias Mitzrayim? Because Yetzias Mitzrayim is the key to getting out of this Golos. If we left there, we know by definition we have the keys to leave here. And that's why we conclude by saying, Hoshata Hocha, maybe this year here, next year, Ba'ar Et Yisrael. And how do we know that we're in the future? If it's not next year, it'll be the year after. But how do we know? We know because of what we're about to celebrate on Seder night itself. So all of a sudden, Yetzias Mitzrayim encompasses all of history. It's no longer a point in history. It actually is overarching on the entirety of history. And that's where the more we look, the more we will see that so much of Seder night, it's accurate to say Seder night faces at the same time backwards and forwards. We find, for example, Hallel is split into two. First two chapters we say in Maggid, the rest we say towards the end. Says the Vilna Gaon, these two parts of Hallel, they're not addressing the same time in history. The first two chapters of Hallel are looking backwards, or at least looking sideways, as we see ourselves coming out of Mitzrayim. But they're about Yetzias Mitzrayim, Betzeis Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. The balance of Hallel is not about leaving Mitzrayim anymore. It's about leaving Golos. It's the second half. The second half of the Seder is forward-looking. It's an amazing statement about Hallel on Seder night. The first part of Hallel is said in celebration of leaving Mitzrayim. The second part of Hallel is said in anticipation and in expectation of leaving Golos for good. And we're already saying Hallel now. How do we have such confidence to say Hallel about a Golos that we haven't left? We haven't left yet, but we know we can because of the first half of Hallel. First we face backwards, but we don't leave the evening before we face forwards. The Sfasemes has a fascinating comment with regard to the Afikoman. As we know, we take the middle of matzah, you break it, and some you eat in motzi matzah, and then the rest you eat later on. So the Sfasemes says, actually, that's what Pesach is. Now, Pesach itself did not all happen at once, in the sense that we left Mitzrayim, but it wasn't permanent. That means we had a piece of Pesach when we left Mitzrayim. But that's not it doesn't end there. Some of Pesach was put away. It will emerge later on, just like the Afikoman does, because it will come back when Pesach is finished. That's when its emanations are fully realized, which means the future Geula itself is the Afikoman of the original Pesach. It's hidden and concealed, and will come back in the right time. And it's interesting to see just how this finds even also halachic expression. We say in the bracha that concludes Maggid. So the bracha begins, Asher ge'alanu v'go'alas avoseinu mimitzrayim, v'yigyanu, etc. Kein Hashem Elokeinu v'lakev v'seinu yagienu l'moadim v'lagolam achirim. So you took us out of Mitzrayim. Similarly, bring us closer to new moadim. Smeichim b'vinyan irecha. V'nochal sham min azvachim v'psachim. V'nodelech ha'shir chadash ha'gul aseinu v'apodus nashenu. And we'll sing a new song of our geula, our redemption. Pedus nafshenu, baruch atah Hashem go'al Yisrael. Now, sometimes the halacha can express something more poignantly than any idea can, because it's the halacha. There's a shaila that the poskim raised with regard to this bracha. As we know, the principle is when you come towards the close of a bracha, you need to mention what's called me'ein hachasima, samach lechasima. You need to mention almost like to wind down or wind up towards the end of the bracha. You mention what the ending of the bracha will be just before you end. For example, in the end of Alamichya, we say, we mention Alaris Valamichya just before the final baruch. Also Kiddush on Friday night, Shabbos Kodesh, we mention Shabbos Kodesh, Baruchat Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbos. It always needs to be just before the conclusion, something about the conclusion. Me'ein HaChasima. And Mishonim and Poskim have raised the question, this bracha does not seem to be conforming with that rule. Because what have we mentioned just before the concluding baruch? We've spoken about the future. Yagienu, smeichem b'vinyan irecha, v'noda l'chashir chodosh, al gulaseinu. In the future, baruch at Hashem, go'al Yisrael. In the past. But the chasima, the conclusion, is about the past. So then near the conclusion should have been me'ein ha'chasima. You can't change subjects so close towards the end zone of the bracha. Except, says the Haggadah HaMalbim, not written by the Malbim, probably, but in his style, says Haggadah HaMalbim, this is Me'ein HaChasima. any geula that will happen in the future is purely an emanation of the geula for Mitzrayim. And therefore, if the concluding baruch is Baruch Atah Hashem Goal Yisrael, about the palm, about Mitzrayim, and you until just until that point have been speaking about the future geula, that's not changing topic. It's the same topic. The future geula is rooted in the geula from Pesach, from Mitzrayim on Pesach. And so, in terms of material for Haggadah, we've only gotten as far as Holach Ma'anya. But I think if we only have saw this major principle about what our Seder is in terms of how it faces, certainly we could say Dayenu, and Mirtz Hashem will pick up again next week and can further our deliberations in Pesach and in Nagel.